I'd like to thank you for inviting me to come speak. And I'm going to be talking about differences between fundamental generalized non-locality. So let me just move on. This talk's going to come in two parts, and they're going to be pretty separate. So if you lose track halfway through the first part, you can always rejoin us in the second part. Enjoy that. So it's basically based around two bits of work I've been doing, but they're linked by this common theme of contrasting quantum and generalized non-locality. Now, just briefly, what I mean by that, obviously there'll be more later on what it means, but what I mean by non-locality is really things that violate local invariant models, so Bell inequality violations. And what I mean by generalized is really allowing anything that obeys the no signaling principle. So I'm going to contrast quantum non-local correlations with these generalized non-local correlations, and maybe look a bit beyond into sort of different frameworks. So I'm going to start off by looking at a result I did with some people in Bristol, with Niall Lidden, Andrea Swinter, and Sandy Popescu, on non-local computation. So the idea here is I'm going to talk about a very natural class of non-local tasks, which it turns out there's a big difference in how well quantum non-locality helps you in these tasks compared to generalized non-locality. And then I'm going to move to a different thing and look at the idea of defining joint measurements and swapping non-locality, like entanglement swapping, but with these generalized non-local correlations, and show again some differences between quantum and general, and hopefully along the way we'll learn a little bit about quantum non-locality and quantum theory in this sort of broader framework. So let me start by non-local computation. Okay, so an overview of this section. I'm going to start by defining a really elementary non-local task, which I'm sure people will have come across before, but the idea is that basically the idea of this initial setup is formulating these Bell inequality type situations as non-local games, basically, played by Alice and Bob, usually. So I'm going to start off with the sort of a task based around the CHSH inequality, and that's going to lead on to the sort of first introduction to this generalized non-locality. And then I'm going to look at the main thing, which is this class of tasks which we call non-local computation. And I'm going to compute how well you can do at this task using quantum, classical, and generalized correlations. And then I'm going to look at an example and some extensions and hopefully reach some conclusions. So let me start with the elementary non-local task. So what we've got to imagine here is Alice and Bob, and they're separated by a large distance. And they're playing the following slightly dry-looking game, but they enjoy it, so there we go. So what they have to do is the following. They're each given by the referee, essentially, or some third party, an input bit. So Alice is given the input bit X, and Bob's given the input bit Y. And they've got to independently do something with their input and potentially any other things they might have lying around their lab. And then they've got to give an output, and they want to produce output bits so that the output obeys this rule. When you see the plus in a little circle, that's addition modulo 2 for the purpose of this talk. So this is a plus b modulo 2. They want it to equal x times y, and these are all bits. So basically, Alice and Bob's outputs want to be correlated, except in the case where x equals y equals 1, in which case they want to be anti-correlated. And so this is the game they're playing. And what we're going to ask here, how we're evaluating their success, is their maximum probability of success. But the best strategy they can come up with, what's the probability of success for that strategy? And there's no question here that their adversary is, they're definitely cooperating to try and do as well as they can in this game. Okay, so the average probability of success is just given by, well, the probability distribution over the inputs times the probability that they get a correct output, essentially. And we can do a little bit of maths and express that in this way, essentially just taking out this minus 1 is mathematically convenient, so we just rewrite it in this form.
So you had a uniform probability for all the
inputs? So in this particular case, you're right, it's a uniform probability. So for this elementary non-local task, I've just particularly picked uniform distribution. Absolutely. What's possible? So these are obviously a bit like the operators that they'd be measuring if they were doing Bell inequality tests. And so they're plus, so we essentially shift from a bit they're trying to use to a plus and minus one valued variable, because mathematically it helps us. And then we can write the success probability in terms of these new plus and minus one valued variables in this hauntingly familiar form. And so it will come as no surprise to anyone that if they're limited to classical strategies, so they're allowed to have anything but only classical things, and they're allowed to maybe met up in advance and exchanged some correlated randomness, but their performance in this game is bounded by the CHSH inequality, which looks like this. And that, just if you go back to the previous formula, it's kind of simple, that gives you 3/4 chance of succeeding in this game. And this this maximum probability of success really is completely equivalent to this Bell inequality. So one nice thing about just thinking in this way is you can take these mathematical things and cast them as, you know, some maximum probability of success in a game, which maybe is more intuitive. And how might they actually do this? Well, a strategy that works is if Alice and Bob both always output 0. Then if they have a uniformly random inputs, it only fails 1/4 of the time, and they win 3/4 of the time. Nice and simple. So what happens if they share quantum states? So suppose in advance, Alice and Bob have got 2/2 of an entangled state, gone off their lap with it, then they're asked to play the game. They can use their entangled state to generate non-local correlations, and by that I mean correlations that can't be expressed in this separable way, so as some global probability distribution over a probability distribution. And anything like that we'll call non-local, for the purposes of this talk. And in that case, their success probability is bounded by the Silson inequality, which is the best you can do in quantum theory at violating the CHSH inequality. And that turns out to give them a maximum success probability of 2+√2/4, which is bigger than 3/4, but still less than 1. So they still can't win perfectly, but they can do better if they've got quantum entangled state. And the reason for that is easy to understand. It's a non-local task, but they've got a kind of non-local resource, so it should give them a bit of a help, and indeed it does. So this is no surprise. Now let's move to slightly more general setup. Suppose we're not, you know, set on quantum theory. We had to admit the world could be anything we like. It might be interesting to ask, suppose we allow Alice and Bob to have some systems which can generate any correlations you like, as long as they don't allow signalling from Alice to Bob or vice versa. So if they do start to allow signalling, then obviously that it becomes very, very, if they're spacelike separated, you get into all sorts of trouble, and in particular, it matters the order in which they're measuring and this kind of thing. But so if we rule that out, which is kind of the minimum we want to rule out, but we allow everything else, then we just allow them to have some, they can do something locally and get outputs A and B, so they plug in their inputs to their local system, X and Y, and they get some outputs A and B according to some probability distribution. And essentially, if you allow access to these super strong non-local correlations, well, it turns out that if you just make this minimum assumption, you can get stronger non-local correlations than in quantum theory, and in particular, you can always win this game. And the way you do it is just Alice and Bob just have one of these sort of special boxes that, you know, somehow exists in this generalized theory. And that box is such that when Alice puts X into her box, she just gets a random bit. And when Bob puts Y into his box, he gets A plus X times Y. And of course, it doesn't matter what order they actually put the things into the box. All you're really interested in here is the correlation. So I'm imagining here that Alice measures first, but you could easily recast this such that Bob measures first, and it would obey the same probability distribution. So if they have this magic box, it's clear that they can win the game. I mean, this distribution definitely wins the game. If you add A to B modulo 2, the A's cancel, and you just get left with X times Y, which is what you wanted. And it's clear that it's not signalling because Alice is just getting a random bit, so she definitely doesn't learn anything about Bob's input. And if Bob is unaware of Alice's output, he also is getting essentially a random bit. So he can't learn anything about Alice's input. So it's non-signalling, it lets you win the game. And again, maybe this isn't that surprising because here we're allowing stronger non-local correlations. it's a non-local task. Maybe we should be able to do better. Okay, so that's the sort of baseline kind of non-local task. And so it seems very natural. So firstly, we can use these kind of tasks to describe Bell and Cyril-Sylla inequalities. And in this particular task, we have this very natural property, greater non-locality leads to greater success probability. So the classical success is less than the quantum success, is less than generalized success. And this seems to be a very natural feature, so we might ask, is this a feature of all non-local tasks? I mean, could we find non-local tasks which aren't like this? Well, you may wonder, but you may find something in a minute. So, I'm going to now define a slightly more complicated game, but it's still the same idea. So, imagine we've got the following challenge. We want Alice and Bob to compute a Boolean function. C is f of z. So what they want to do is essentially perform this box here. Z comes in with some operation, and you get some bit out, C is f of z. And I'm allowing here, this is basically a decision problem, so I'm allowing any arbitrary number of input bits, but it comes out to one output bit. So any Boolean function of n bits. And suppose I have an additional constraint, which is that I don't want either Alice or Bob to learn anything about C or Z. I want them together to compute the answer, but I want each individually to remain ignorant of what it is they're doing. So a situation where this might be useful, for instance, is you can imagine that maybe Z is some sensitive information, some government agencies acquired some secret information about the enemy, and you want to make a decision about whether to launch an attack on them based on this sensitive information. But maybe if you're in a position of power to make this decision, maybe you're not necessarily the right person. Maybe you're not quite clever enough to evaluate whether you should make the decision to launch the attack or not. I'm not thinking of anyone in particular here, but you can imagine such a situation arising. And then you might want to recruit some clever agents to make the decision for you, but you may not trust them with this sensitive information, and you may not trust them with the knowledge that you're about to launch an attack. So one way you could get around that is to somehow, you want them to compute the decision without learning these information. So how do you do this? Well, the only way really to stop them learning anything about this information is as follows. You essentially, you split Z up into two bits, one X, one Y, that you distribute to Alice and Bob. And only in the correlations between those bits is any information stored. Each bit individually is maximally random. And then you want Alice to do a computation of her bit with essentially what she sees as a random input bit. Then she generates some output. And then you want to collect their decision by looking at the correlations in their outputs. So this is the challenge that we're setting them. So ideally, given random input bit strings, and here we're going to actually allow non-uniform probability distributions as well in a minute, Alice and Bob must generate output bits such that the sum of their output bits is equal to the function evaluated on the logical input, essentially. So this is a very important picture, so if people don't get this, then they should raise now. But the basic idea is you take some Boolean function, you essentially split it into two sides, you make both people do one side, and then together they compute the answer. And this is a subcategory of distributed computation. In distributed computation, generally, you give Alice X and Bob Y, and you want A plus B to be S of X and Y. Here, we don't want Alice and Bob to learn anything about the input either, so we split the input. And we call this non-local computation. Okay, so now we just go through, similar to last time, looking at how well they can do with various resources. So if I start with, in reverse order to last time, I'm going to start with the generalized non-local correlations. So suppose, well, actually, firstly, before I carry on, I'm just going to talk a bit about this probability distribution over the inputs. Now, if we don't want them to learn anything about Z, we could still have any prior over Z, essentially the logical input to this function, but once we've got that prior over Z, we need to split it up such that each person sees maximally random bits. So the probability of X and Y is just the probability of Z over the number of strings consistent with Z. And then it ensures that each person doesn't learn anything about Z. And with generalized non-local correlations, as before, essentially you can always win this game. Alice and Bob can always do this computation for whoever it is that asks them. And they don't learn anything, and when he collects in their answers, he'll get the correct decision. Well, if he had the right algorithm, obviously, but he'll get the decision he was looking for, anyway. And it's kind of, again, it's sort of trivial to see how you do that, just because the output bits are individually random, and everything's only stored in the correlations, it's no signaling by kind of construction. So you just give them this magic box, such that the correlations are equal to the right answer. Okay, so this is as before. Now let's look at the quantum success probabilities. So again, we write the probability of success in this form, where we've changed it essentially from 0, 1 variables to plus and minus 1 variables. So you can see that in the case where they satisfy the relation, this thing is 0, and then this thing values to 1, essentially. And in the case where they don't satisfy, this negative cancels out that, and you get 0. So. And then we do a mathematical trick. Now, there's nothing physical here that we're doing, but we're going to represent this equation by some states in a larger Hilbert space. We're going to consider Alice and Bob share some quantum state psi. But as well as that, for mathematical convenience, we're going to bolt on an additional bit of Hilbert space, just in the proof, to represent their input that they've been given. So this is just a mathematical statement. If you evaluate this expression, then right, and you understand, then this is just the expected value of this thing. I should have an expected value on this slide. There you go. So when you plug these equations into this formula, you essentially just generate this line. But the nice thing about this formula is it has some nice symmetries, and we can use it. So the important thing is going to be phi. Alpha and beta here are normalized states in this large Hilbert space. And if we look at, well, going from this equation, it's clear that as alpha and beta are normalized states,
P sub n, that's the probability that parity of x and y has that value given the distribution.
P sub n is the prior over z, essentially, yeah. So it's the prior over x plus y, which is you're allowed to freely specify. So it's the prior on this sensitive information that. If alpha and beta are normalized states, then the maximum that this term can be is just the maximum eigenvalue of phi. So we write that like this. And then we can actually look at the eigenstates and eigenvalues of phi, and we find that it has these nice eigenstates, which are essentially, sort of Hadamard transform eigenstates. This is the bitwise inner product between u and x, the inputs. And the eigenvalue is just this quantity. And that essentially means that your maximum probability of success quantumly is just the maximum eigenvalue, which is essentially the maximum value of this. Obviously, the norm, the operator norm is the modulus of the maximum eigenvalue. So this is the best you can do quantumly. And I suppose the talk's not the best place to go through it, but yeah. So what about classically? Well, now the really interesting thing is that we derived this from kind of quantum reasoning, and it looks reasonably complicated. But the slightly surprising thing is that you can achieve it with a completely classical strategy. If Alice and Bob just adopt the following strategy, where Alice gives u dot x, and Bob gives u dot y, maybe plus 1, if it would turn out that the sign was the wrong way around. This plus delta is just correcting the sign, so the maximum eigenvalue, sometimes you want the maximum modulus eigenvalue, and if it's negative, you need to include a delta, so that you get the maximum rather than the minimum success probability, essentially. But the idea is that u here is the u that was the maximum eigenvalue, and if they perform this strategy, then their probability of success is just given by this expression. This is kind of clear to see why, if you just think about plugging these formulas into the original formula for probability here. So if A is just u dot x and B is u dot y, then this becomes u dot z. And that becomes f of z. And then that's what we have. So g f of z plus u dot z. And that's the same as what we had for the quantum case. So this is, well, when we discovered this, this was a very surprising result. And I still think this is a very surprising result. So what we have here is, for all non-local computations with a single output bit, so decision problems, where Alice and Bob must jointly compute the function without individually learning anything about the input or the output, quantum non-locality is essentially useless. It's definitely a non-local task because generalized non-locality helps you. You have these generalized non-local correlations, you can always succeed. And almost all of these tasks, classically, you can't succeed perfectly. So there is a gap here, so it's genuinely a non-local task. But quantum non-locality doesn't help you at all. And hopefully that tells us something quite interesting about the nature of quantum as opposed to just any old non-locality.
So if it's non-local in the sense that you define these as non-local games?
Yeah, exactly. Well, but more strongly, it's non-local because... So if it turned out that you could always do as well classically in these games as you could with the generalized non-local correlations, then I suppose it would be a bad non-local game. You might have set it up thinking it was a non-local game, but actually there's some winning classical strategy that always wins. So the interesting thing here is there is a gap between the generalized non-local correlations and the classical. So it definitely has some non-local component. And in fact, the classical strategy is really bad. Okay, the best the classical strategy can do for any function is just the simplest linear approximation to that function, essentially. They can't do it. Classically, you can't compute anything non-linear with this, in this way, in this non-local way. And the same is true quantumly, but not with these arbitrary non-local problems.
Sorry,
yeah.
I
was
assuming something.
Yeah.
Why doesn't it identify the and function?
Sorry?
Doesn't the and function have just a single output bit?
I'll look at the and function, yeah. But the and function we'll look at in just a moment. That is my example in the next slide.
Okay.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that quantum theory doesn't give you any benefit over classical for computing the AND function. The best you can do, well, let's look at it. Amazingly, it's the AND function. So the non-local version of the AND function looks like this. They want to achieve A plus B is X1 plus Y1, X2 plus Y2. And classically, the best they can do is essentially, if we assume... just to get the numbers easy, we assume the uniform probability of the inputs. That's the best they can do is, again, just guess zero on both sides.
Sorry, okay, so that wasn't what I was asking. Okay. So I was asking about the CHSH.
Right.
But that's the input is coded differently.
Yes, so the idea, the CHSH game is not a non-local computation of any function. So there's no starting function you could non-localize to get CHSH. That's exactly, so it doesn't fit within this category of tasks. And in particular, and in the CHSH game, Alice and Bob do learn something about the inputs, because they learn either X or Y, and those are important inputs. It's not the same as here, where there's this kind of logical input, Z, which they don't know about. But yeah, anyway, it doesn't fit within this class of tasks, the CHSH. So anyway, it turns out that classical and quantum both can't do better than just outputting zero. Which is kind of surprising, but generalized non-local correlations always win. And so just before we move on, I just want to talk about a few extensions of these. So the first one is that it really easily generalizes any number of particles. I just used two here for convenience, but essentially everything generalizes, and each party essentially just, the classical strategy is just each party does u dot their input, and then you sum all the outputs. And if you need to change the sign, one of the parties just flips their bit. But it's very easy to see that it generalizes to any number of parties. And for multiple output bits, it doesn't generalize quite as easily, because with multiple output bits, you have to specify more carefully what your game is. With one output bit, it's clear there's only a unique measure of success, really, which is, did you get it right? For multiple output bits, you might evaluate either, did you get it completely right, or maybe were you close to the right answer? So, in particular, if you evaluate the output, a multiple output bit case by looking at the number of correct bits you got, so how close you are in sort of very naive measure, then it does generalize to that. It's essentially, it turns out that the best thing you can do is just optimize the probability of each bit independently. Yeah?
Would that be the expectation of the number of correct bits then? Is this probabilistic?
Yeah, exactly. So the probability of success would change into the expectation of the number of correct bits. Exactly. So you can think of that as your optimal average score if you're scored by the number of correct bits.
Can you say anything about the probability of them all being correct?
Well, at the moment, no. So that's something that would be a nice generalization. It doesn't, the proof we use for this doesn't generalize naturally. We tried, but it doesn't generalize naturally. Because essentially, you end up with two terms you're trying to optimize simultaneously, and they're different. So you end up in a tricky situation.
But you don't have a contradiction together?
We don't have a contradiction, though, exactly. We haven't proved anything at the moment about that case. And just because of the way we've constructed the proof, actually this whole thing applies to a much broader class of tasks, which is any non-local task, which is A plus B is f of x and y. So here we don't have the same constraint, they don't learn anything about inputs. We just say, given any distributed computation, if it's true that this object, which is just a mathematical object defined in terms of this game, has its maximal eigenvalue, eigenstate as one of these essentially transformed states, then quantum will be no better than classical for that game. And, okay, it's not clear that there are any particularly intuitive games that are in this class but not non-local computation, but there might be, and it's certainly a bigger class. So anyway, that's kind of mostly what I wanted to say on non-local computation, so let me just conclude this section. So what we've done here is looked at, I think it's definitely arguably a natural class of tasks, this non-local computation. It seems like something you might very naturally want to do. It's a broad class of tasks because it involves any Boolean function. And we've shown that generalized non-local correlations allow perfect success, but quantum non-locality is essentially useless. And so an interesting open question at the moment is, do all non-quantum non-local correlations help in some task of this type? If I give you a non-local correlation, a probability distribution, P of A, B given X, Y, that has non-local correlations, but it isn't achievable in quantum theory, is there some game of this type which it helps me at? If that was the case, then we could completely characterize quantum non-locality as saying it's all the non-locality that doesn't, it's any non-local correlation that doesn't help you in non-local computation. That's good. Yeah?
Is there an obvious procedure for looking at a non-local correlation and determining whether or not it is quantum?
Well, there are some non-local correlations which obviously adapt themselves to these games. The problem is you can write down many more. For most non-local correlations you write down, there wouldn't be a natural game which would be immediately obvious that it would connect to.
Right.
But that doesn't mean it wouldn't help you as a result, necessarily.
But my question was, if I write down non-local correlations, yep. How do I tell whether it's non-quantum?
Oh, well, I mean, I suppose find some Cyrilson in the quality that violates. That's how you have to do it. There's not a simple, obvious way of doing it.
It's not necessary and sufficient to see if it violates or not doesn't violate the Cyrilson inequality.
Well, I mean, I suppose you'd have to check all Cyrilson inequalities, and anyway, I think there is no well-defined way of looking at a probability distribution and seeing whether it's achievable quantum, other than trying to achieve it. Maybe there are probably some tells you could find that would probably boil down to violating some kind of Cyrilson inequality. But yeah, so it's not immediately clear that this is a practical benefit, but it certainly would be conceptually interesting. If we found this was the case, then that would be, I think, quite an interesting. So maybe it's a deep insight into what quantum non-locality can and can't do. And at the moment, there's still this big problem of, although we have quantum computers and we understand quantum theory, if someone gives us a task, we're still pretty bad at working out whether quantum theory can help us do that task. And something like this result would really hopefully give us a good stepping stone on being able to look more at tasks and seeing if quantum theory could help. Okay. So, all those people who kind of drifted off during that bit, it might be a good time to maybe join the flow again. So, this is another topic, very related, still talking about generalized non-local correlations, but here I'm going to look at the idea of joint measurements and, so like, analogs of the Bell measurements, and non-locality swapping, which is an analog of entanglement swapping. So the question is, do these things exist for these generalized situations, and how can we discuss that and investigate it? So this is work I did with John Barrett from here, who's strangely not here, but so I was working with him on this. So the first thing I'm going to do is introduce a general framework for probabilistic theories. Now this is going to be familiar to a lot of you here, because this is basically Lucien and John's kind of different generalized probabilistic frameworks. I just want to run you through that quickly so I can... So this is already known stuff that is a very useful way of representing quantum theory and other more general theories in a common framework so you can investigate them. And in particular, I'm going to be focusing on John's model, in which he defines this thing called generalized non-signaling mechanics, which is essentially a way of allowing all these non-local correlations, allowing any system which has one of these generalized non-local correlations. And then I'm going to look in particular here at how you represent measurements in these frameworks and give some results about measurements in this generalized non-signaling mechanics. So in the world in which all these non-local correlations that are stronger than quantum theory exist, what do measurements look like and what can we say about them? And I'm going to show that actually there's really quite severe limitations on those measurements. And that in some ways the world, this world that looks so rich with all these super strong non-local correlations, is actually very unrich, poor, in terms of what you can, the versatility of measurements and dynamics. And then I'm going to look at an application of that, which basically shows that there's no analog of these entanglement swapping for generalized non-local correlations. So what's this generalized framework? Well, instead of representing quantum states as density matrices or as states in Hilbert space, we can take a more operational approach and think about them as lists of probabilities for measurement outcomes. And this is quite appealing because, for starters, it connects more with what people do in the lab, and secondly, it generally involves real numbers that have a physical meaning, and it's much less abstract and mathematical than the formalism of Hilbert space quantum mechanics. So what do we do? Well, we say we represent states by a vector, which is essentially the probabilities of outcomes for some set of measurements, which we call the fiducial measurements, following Lucien's terminology. So the idea here is that any system can be characterized, throughout this we're going to be looking mainly at finite dimensional systems, well, entirely at finite dimensional systems, or systems that can be characterized by a finite quantity of measurements. So there's maybe more complicated stuff that come in if everything was continuous and infinite, but we're not going to think about that too much here. And I kind of don't think that anything particularly new and exciting will happen there. So as a simple example, you might think the qubit can be characterized by, one way of characterizing the state of a qubit would be through three fiducial measurements, the spin in the x, y, and z directions. And then your vector would look like this, the probability of different outcomes for these three spin measurements. And then this is just as good a representation of the state as the density matrix would be. And the nice thing about this formalism, though, is because we haven't put density matrices and Hilbert spaces in by hand, it's much more broad than formalism of quantum theory. And we can also use the same framework to express different theories. So in particular, we could look at a classical probability theory, and we can look at this generalized non-signaling mechanics, which we'll get to in a minute. But there are lots of potential theories you could write down in this language involving probabilities. Okay, so that's the state of a single system. If we have a multipartite system, then essentially it just follows through as you expect. Yep.
So when you define your six outcomes, yep, there, should I think of that as a single six outcome measurement so that the only constraint on probability,
no,
is the sum? Or
so you should think of it as three, there's definitely three measurements here with binary The thing that characterizes this is 3 2 outcome measurements. And that's these numbers you have to hold in your mind. They're defining characteristics. Yeah. I mean, you could obviously pick as a fiducial measurement a single informationally complete measurement. But it turns out that that's much less interesting when you get to the later bits of the talk, because then there's no really interesting way of defining a generalized non-signaling mechanics in that base with that starting point, essentially. So it's more interesting if you pick several fiducial measurements. Okay. And it's worth pointing out as well that although I've called these SIGREX, single Y, and single Z, in this framework you've really got to leave behind your quantum intuitions and just think of these as the three defining measurements of this quantum system. You know, the fact that they connect to the SIGREX operation in the Hilbert space is not something you want to be concerned about. You want to, you know, you just have three devices, measurement one, measurement two, and measurement three, and you know that they're sufficient to characterize the state, and you investigate what different probabilities you can get for them. But the idea of this is it kind of replaces the Hilbert space formalism. Okay. So what about multi-party systems? Well, again, it's very simple, really. You can represent the state of a multi-party system by a joint probability distribution, where you do a fiducial measurement on each subsystem, and then you look at the joint probability of the measurement outcomes. Now, it's quite a strong, surprising result that both quantum and classical probability theory you can represent like this, that there isn't any intrinsic joint measurements that you have to include to characterize the state. You really can characterize the state by doing every combination of fiducial single system measurements. But it certainly is true in quantum theory. If you had two qubits and you measure every combination of sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z on both of them, then look at the measurement outcome probabilities, you can characterize the state. But that's quite a strong property, but we're going to assume it here. And so just as an example, how you might look at these things if you're trying to do actually specific cases, a nice way of representing these probability distributions is in the form of a table where essentially along each side corresponds to a different party, and then the sort of outer brackets correspond to the different measurement choices, and the inner brackets correspond to the different measurement outputs.
Question?
Yep.
You said you were going to assume this.
It's not. This isn't separability.
Well, maybe that's not a good
yeah.
example. Whatever you just said.
Yeah.
Are you making another assumption that there are no more fiducial measurements locally than you would need in a quantum system?
Well, basically, I'm going to...
I mean, when you compare the, you know, the generalized quantum...
Right, so what I'm going to do is say I've got a system which is characterized by this number of fiducial measurements with this many outputs as a starting point, essentially. My different types of system... I'm just going to kind of, they're labelled by the number of fiducial measurements they have and the number of outputs. And then I'm going to look at the possible states, which are basically the probability distributions that you can get. But in some ways, I don't want to put in anywhere. So quantum theory also has the property that you can characterise systems by, there are certain numbers of fiducial measurements you need for different types of systems. Like, for instance, 3 for qubit, maybe 8 for the spin 1 system. But I'm not going to worry about that here. I'm just saying you can start off and tell me what the different systems, how many fiducial measurements they have, and what number of outputs are.
Oh, so these won't just be qubits, I mean, generalized.
Yeah, they could be any.
They could be any number.
Yeah, so you just give me a system and say this is characterized by 10 fiducial measurements, each binary output. And then, you know, there's some set of allowed probability distributions then that you can achieve. Okay, so this table represents the sigma state. I don't know if it's necessarily interesting to go into detail, but you can sort of see that they both measure the same. If Alice chooses the same measurement as Bob, then they get anti-correlated answers. If they choose different measurements, they get completely uncorrelated answers. Hence the sigma state. This is really just to give you a handle on, because it's quite an abstract formalism, it's quite nice to see some samples occasionally. And all my examples will be essentially based in this paradigm where you pick sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z as your fiducial measurements. Okay, so what do we know about these probability distributions? What do they have to obey? Well, firstly, they're probability distributions. They definitely should obey positivity and normalization. Otherwise, really, we lose all way of physically interpreting them as probabilities. And the other thing we're going to impose for sure is we want them to be non-signaling. And what that basically means is that for any joint system, if we don't know, well, let's think firstly about two-party systems. If Alice doesn't know Bob's output, she shouldn't be able to tell anything about his input, because that input could then be a message that Alice would learn. And Bob could be miles away, so we can't let that happen. So it turns out this requirement that is essentially that if you essentially trace out one party, then you lose the dependence. The other parties don't depend on that party's measurement choice. But it essentially just corresponds mathematically to what you need to stop these people signaling to each other. And it turns out that it's sufficient to just assume one party versus the rest, and the other axioms, and you can then generate every subset can't signal to every other subset. So if you ensure that one party can't signal to the rest, you can work out that nobody can signal to anyone, or no group can signal to any other group. Yep.
Just, is it each party?
Yeah, each party, yeah. So this is true for all parties, but yeah, you don't need to start off by considering every subset, every decomposition. Okay. So these are the things we'll require, but we know that not every probability distribution like satisfying those rules. They're like the minimal set of things we should ask for. If we didn't satisfy any of those, we'd have a really crazy world that we wouldn't know how to understand. But it's certainly true that quantum theory can't usually generate all probability distributions satisfying that. So, for instance, with the example I gave earlier, where the fiducial measurements were sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z, there's certainly no quantum state that looks like this. It just gives well-defined sigma x equals sigma y equals sigma z equals plus 1. We know that quantum state doesn't exist. So that isn't in the set of allowed quantum states, but it is an allowed. It does satisfy all the three earlier conditions. It's perfectly valid. Yep.
But that is an allowed state for a larger state than a larger system than a qubit. And so it
right, yes.
So you said before that we weren't supposed to think about the Hilbert space dimension.
No. But if I tell you that this is a system characterized by three fiducial measurements, then I've told you that it's not a larger system, because if it was, it wouldn't be. What I'm saying is these systems carry the fiducial measurements are supposed to be the number of measurements you need to completely characterize the state.
Then
so you can't suddenly...
What should I make of a system characterized by five fiducial measurements, since a qubit has three and a qubit has eight?
Well, no, but you could pick a different set of measurements. You could always have a redundant set of measurements as well, if you wanted. It has to be sufficient, but it doesn't have to be the minimum. The fiducial set doesn't have to be the minimum set.
So if you give me eight measurements, then I don't know whether you're talking about a qubit or a qubit, but I know you're not talking about.
Okay, let me just go to the next slide. I think it will help with this point. So the idea is really this one, I think. Because let me just quickly jump to the next slide. No, I'll just talk quickly about generalized non-signaling. I'll come back to this point in a moment. Okay, so generalized non-signaling mechanics. Essentially, what we do to generate that is we literally just allow all things which satisfy our minimal set of requirements. So we allow all probability distributions which are positive, normalized, and non-signaling. And so this state would fit within that. So we can view both the set of quantum states and the set of generalized non-signaling mechanics states as convex sets, because if you mix two states, you still get an allowed state. And so what's interesting here is that the shape of the generalized non-signaling mechanic set is characterized just by the number of fiducial measurements and the number of outputs, because you just allow everything then consistent with it. There's no other information you can give. But the shape of the set of quantum states will vary depending on what you actually picked as your fiducial measurements. But given any choice, there always is some convex set, which is the set of allowed quantum states. So when I said previously that the previous state lies outside the set of allowed quantum states, I sort of mean after you've fixed what the convex set of allowed quantum states is. So you've really specified your fiducial measurements, you've generated the set of all probability distributions consistent with them in quantum theory, and then this is outside. So after you've picked sigma x.
So
You've drawn the set of quantum states as being kind of pointy around the edges. Is that actually the case?
Well, I tried to make it smooth around some of the edges, pointy around the edges.
Is it pointy around any of its edges, I guess? Where is that?
In higher dimensions, I think it is, yeah. It has edges that are, yeah. It has flat surfaces. But you have to go to higher dimensions.
Higher dimensions.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Multiple systems. Anyway, yeah, so you can get flat edges. Yeah.
Is it some part of this generalized, what is that?
Non-singling mode.
Yeah. Okay. So have you described the whole structure?
No, I haven't described anything about dynamics or extra dimensions yet.
So it's justified to say call it mechanics?
Well, it isn't at the moment, I agree, but the idea is to proceed in that direction. So this is just really, all I've talked about now is states, essentially. I haven't talked about anything. Agreed. So yes, this is a critical point, that the shape of the quantum set will vary. There are lots of equivalent quantum sets. Firstly, I just want to make the point that in terms of these fiducial measurements, these states, because we're allowing everything consistent with these, no signaling condition, things like the magical box we made up earlier appear in this generalized non-signaling mechanics. This is a perfectly valid probability distribution in generalized non-signaling mechanics for two binary output fiducial measurements on each side. And so in particular, generalized non-signaling mechanics contains stronger non-local correlations than quantum theory. And then I might want to So now what we've got is we've got states and we've got fiducial measurements. So what else do we need to have in our theory? Well, we know, for instance, in quantum theory that you can do lots of measurements that aren't fiducial. You can do lots of measurements that aren't sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z. So you should have a way of representing them. And so in particular, you can do this sigma 45 degrees measurement, and you can also do a Bell measurement on two systems, which definitely aren't fiducial, but they're just extra other measurements you can do. So what are the allowed measurements? You might ask, is there any analog to the generalized non-signaling mechanics? Are there other measurements that aren't fiducial that you can still do and are interesting? And so basically, what might you require of a measurement? Well, you require that the measurement generates positive normalized probability distributions for every allowed state. First thing a measurement has to do. And because your set of states is a convex set, you can imagine these convex combinations being genuine mixtures of states. You can, if you have the probability for measurements has got to act linearly on the state, because if you really tossed a coin and paired state one or state two, and then you did a measurement, you'd expect that the probability of the outcomes was just probability of the coin times the outcome for state one times the probability of the coin. So, well, actually, that only actually gets you to affine maps, but then you can extend it to linear quite easily. That's a bit of a fiddle, but yeah, you can do it. So let me quickly So basically, the interesting thing is that because the thing that you need to do for measurements is you've got to make them work on all states, essentially. Your measurement has to give you a valid result for all states. And because in the GNSM you have more states, it turns out there's stronger constraints on the measurements because they've got to work for all these extra states. So, in fact, you end up with less measurements in the generalized non-signaling mechanics than you did in quantum mechanics. So here's an example. So this sigma 45 degrees in this formalism would look like this. But that would lie outside, that measurement lies outside the set of GNSM measurements. And I'm just going to give you, basically, this is quite near the end, but I just want to give you some results about what you can say about GNSM measurements. So the first thing you can say about them is that they can all be represented by positive vectors. Well, that's kind of a bit dry. So it's very useful, and it turns out to be useful in the later properties, but this is a bit of a non-physical property. So what about physical property? Well, here's one. All GNSS measurements on single and bipartite systems can be performed using only fiducial measurements on the individual systems. Now that is a really strong, slightly surprising result. It says, essentially for single and bipartite systems, there are no new measurements. Essentially, if you start off with some set of fiducial measurements, that's all you're allowed. There are no other new measurements that are interesting. This includes things like you could measure the first particle in some base or using one of the fiducial measurements, and then depending on the output, you could do a selection of different fiducial measurements on the second system. But that's still clearly just nothing new, right? Those are things we totally expect to exist as measurements, but they're not really doing anything new and exciting. And the interesting thing for one or two party systems is that that's all you can do. Now this was proved sort of in the past for binary output measurements, but this is completely general. This is for any size of system. And it looked, what we hoped was that this would generalize and that all measurements would turn out to be of this kind of trivial type. But unfortunately, we then found the counterexample. So for three systems, there is a non-trivial new measurement that can't be done by doing just a sequence of fiducial measurements. However, it's still kind of trivial. It can be done using just fiducial measurements and post-selection. Every measurement in GNSM can be done using just fiducial measurements on individual systems and post-selection. And so that's, in some ways, even though there's a few slightly new things, they're still really, really weak things. Post-selection is quite often quite a strong thing to be able to do, but here the thing is there's nothing that's really a true joint measurement. You really are stuck with doing individual measurements on individual systems, and then maybe you could do some post-selection. But what you really want to be able to do is something like a Bell measurement, which is a true joint measurement, and there's just nothing like that. So an illustration of the weakness of this kind of setup is that it isn't sufficient to do entanglement swapping or an analog of entanglement swapping. If you just have individual fiducial measurements and post-selection, you can't ever, if Alice has some non-local correlations with Bob, and in fact this generalizes that if she shares any number of correlated systems of any size with Bob, and Bob shares any number of correlated systems of any size with Charlie in GNSM, there's just no way for Bob to introduce any non-local correlations at all between Alice and Charlie using any GNSM measurement. And that's basically because, I'll just quickly finish up, this is really close to the end. So the reason is because all that Bob can do is essentially do an individual fiducial measurement and post-select. So when he does his set of fiducial measurements on the individual systems, he collapses these systems on Alice's side and these systems on Bob's side. And so even with post-selection, the best he can do is generate some distribution times a product of a product state, essentially, on Alice and Charlie's side. And it's straightforward to see that there's no way. I mean, this is definitely a local state. It's exactly of the form we require for it to be a local state. It's decomposable. So let me just conclude. So basically, we've constructed a theory omitting these generalized non-local correlations. And we can put that in the same framework as we can express quantum theory and compare them. And what you find is that there's no really truly joint measurements in GNSM with generalized non-singular mechanics. It's much weaker for measurements. And actually, this actually carries over to dynamics. I've talked about measurements because they're kind of simpler to describe, but the dynamics is also similarly weak. And there's no analog of entanglement swapping for generalized non-local correlations. And there's this way you can always do them with fiducial measurements and post-selection. And I'll just leave up the summary of the differences I've talked about in this talk between GNSM and quantum theory. The GNSM has more allowed states, stronger non-locality, and allows perfect non-local computation. But on the other hand, quantum theory has more measurements and dynamics. It's kind of dynamically richer, and measurement gives you more options. And it's got more versatile non-local correlations. They can be swapped around and maneuvered as you wish, but it doesn't do non-local computation. And so, I mean, the program of this kind of direction of research is really, can we, you know, how can we use these sort of comparisons to really better understand quantum theory and potentially anything that was beyond it. And that's me.
We also have just a few questions.
Because you mean that in GISM there's no quantum teleportation?
Yeah. That's so if you could teleport, then you could entangle as well.
Okay, so because you mean that quantum teleportation would see that quantum theory out of the set of also
Well, it's these kind of things which are really hopeful. Okay, so I agree. So what we really want to try and do, one thing that's really would be really good, to come up with some nice neat principles which really pin down to quantum theory, and that would certainly rule out this model. But on the other hand, there's, you know, you can pick any convex set of states, and we don't know much about the ones in between quantum theory and GNSM at the moment. So it would be great if that were true, and it's certainly something that would be worth researching, but. At the moment, it's very early days.
And one last question.
So your first line summarizes that in once states and measurements are dual to each other, quantum gives you a bigger set of measurements. It's using more states. What do you get if you demand that the states and measurements in a theory be dual to each other? It would be self-dual.
Well, that's, again, an interesting question. So, I mean, well, maybe quantum theory, but I don't know. And not much is known, really, about any of these framework theories other than quantum theory and GNSM. So, and it's early days for this kind of thing, but it's certainly there's loads of interesting questions like that. Yeah.
Okay, so that's
kind of
totally